Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Helen Phillips, author of The Need, published in July by Simon & Schuster. The Need is Helen's fifth book, preceded by her children's book, Here Where the Sunbeams Are Green, and yet they were... that sounds like it's the same book. Here Where the Sunbeams Are Green, that's one, and yet they were happy, that's two, The Beautiful Bureaucrat, that's three, and Some Possible Solutions, which is four, each of which have received various awards. She's also received, and it is my favorite award ever in the entire history of the world, is the Italo Calvino Prize in Fabulous Fiction, which is on my fabulous bucket list. So
good. My fingers are crossed for you.
Thank you. Your fabulous fingers. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, Tin House, lots of other publications. So The Need is a scary book, but it's a funny book. It's a sad book. It's a tragic book. It's an heroic book. But mainly, especially since we're trying to sell books, it's a book that's really hard to put down. So, like, do we have an unreliable narrator? I don't know. Do we have a parallel universe? Beats me. Do we have two matching pennies? I can't really say. Do we like someone or another? But when a book asks you these questions and you can't really answer them right away, you know something cool is going on. You know you're on to something. And those are the kind of books that I really, really like. So The Need starts out being something. Then quite adroitly, it morphs into something else. It kind of funnels and tunnels, both literally and figuratively. And as it does, our questions begin to arise almost contemporaneously, as they do for our very unlikely protagonists. And our protagonists are, as I said, not to beat a dead horse, are two sides of the same coin. It's a book I will not soon forget, maybe with the beatific dream every once in a while, with the odd, and I do mean odd, nightmare thrown in for good measure. So with that, Helen, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. So spoiler alert, I tend to jump around and ask silly and weird questions, just so you know.
Okay. I can't wait.
Okay. Let's start with, who is Molly?
Who is Molly? Molly is a paleobotanist. She is a scientist who studies plant fossils, and she is also the mother of a four-year-old girl and a baby boy. And she is someone whose scientific inclinations and logical mind are being somewhat challenged by the experience and intensity of early motherhood.
So without, and we will go into, you know, what the book is essentially about and Phillips 66 and all that, but If you're delving more into Molly and the other, you know, she's got a lot of problems. And that's why I was saying the book kind of funnels and tunnels, because she's got a lot of problems, and you know that right away. So she's got strengths. She's got weaknesses. You told us a little bit of her life's work. But let's, like, if you had a whiteboard and you just did, like, pros and cons, strengths and weaknesses, what are both? What are her strengths? What are her weaknesses?
I feel like our strengths and weaknesses are so often one and the same. I mean, I think that her greatest strength really is the intensity of the love she has for her children. And that is also her greatest weakness. And it's the thing that makes her vulnerable. And it's the thing that makes her anxious. And it's the thing that makes her scared. So that, I mean, in terms of primary strength and primary weakness, that's where I would put it for her.
Okay, here's one that's off the wall. So when I was reading one of your interviews, this popped in my head. It said you were the imaginary love child of Patti Smith, Joan Didion, and Audrey Hepburn. And that's,
yes.
And that seems to me weirder than pretty much everything in your book. But, I mean, first of all, I don't know how they would have a love child. But second of all, what exactly does that mean?
Well, whatever it is, I'll have it written on my gravestone, because I admire all of those women very much.
Oh, yeah.
I can't really speak to that, except that I was honored by all three comparisons.
Yeah, and also you got Bloob, like, incredible, like Emily Mandel, who I interviewed for Station 11, and Rebecca, who I interviewed for The Great Believers. They were great. They weren't even like blurbs. They were just like very nice synopses of the book. And yeah, that was very impressive. The whole publicity kit I got.
Yeah, I'm glad you liked it. I mean, it's such a with a book, you spend so much time in solitude with your own mind. And in my case, because my writing really arises from my anxieties, sort of stewing in my own anxieties and my own questions. And when you're writing it in isolation for, you know, however long it takes, you know, 4 to 10 years, depending on the book, you just don't know how it's going to land with people. So to share it with writers who I love both of those writers so much, and to send it out to them and have them read it and respond to it, it's a really profound experience. I mean, that's what I feel like a book for me begins, it's a conversation I need to have, and it begins as a conversation I'm having with myself by writing the book. And then the moment where that conversation expands outward and other people read the book and respond to it, it's really cool. And in a way, you don't quite know what you've created until it's bouncing off of other brains. And when it's bouncing off of brains as admirable as those two, it is, it's pretty much the biggest thrill.
I know. And doing what I do, I have the luxury of, you know, having talked to them, feeling in my own mind like I made a friend. But it's like, you know, after talking to them, I realize how valuable their words are. You know, it's just like I said, a luxury for me. And yeah, so as soon as I see that, I go, wow, she likes it. Well, then I'm going to like it too. But, you know, and I did.
Good. But I guess that's the idea of having someone support your work early on that way.
Yeah. But there's other people like David Mitchell, you know, Cloud Atlas and all that. He won't let anybody blurb any of his books, like Thomas Pynchon, you know. It's like, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I actually didn't know that.
Yeah. And it's really funny because the back is just empty. He's a really nice guy too.
Well, and I can understand that desire to... to me, that seems connected perhaps to a desire to have the reader go in without any preconceived ideas. And I do understand how that could feel very valuable.
You know, the other thing is that in the interviews and in the reviews, and actually in your own words too, you say the book scares you. And then you talk about an incident that happened with you. And then one of the other reviewers, of course, another mother, had a situation, you know, where she nailed a window shut and all that. This is like resonant, but you know, I'm an old white guy, and so and especially about the breastfeeding and all, I can't relate. Not that it changed anything about my appreciation of the book, but it's really hard to relate to those things. So if we cut to the core of a lot of the motherhood issues, you know, the tantrums, and the pooping and the peeing, and the throwing up and the breastfeeding and the breast milk coming and all that. Why was that such a crucial, which it was, part of the book?
Well, I think that, I think it's not something, certainly for me as a reader, it's not something that I see evoked as much as I want to see it evoked, because that aspect of raising children is a big part of the human experience. And when I started lactating and nursing my children, I knew nothing about it. And not only did I know nothing about it, but also it struck me as, though it's a pretty common human experience throughout history, it's extremely surreal and sci-fi that you are suddenly a food source for this other being. And using a breast pump is a very odd machine that is this sort of intermediary between your identity as an animal, as a mother, and the other identities that you have as a working person or before having children. So I just found it such rich territory, just because it's so surreal and so common at the same time. And so I just wanted to bring representation to that. And I look forward to reading many other representations of it, but I just wanted to bring one possible representation of it. And to me, it's very much a book about the body and the way that having children makes you aware of your own body in a really acute way, makes you aware of your responsibility to other bodies, And so I wanted that texture. That was critical to me, to have that physical texture to the book.
Yeah, and when I ask questions, if I get close to a spoiler, because there's tons of spoilers you could do, some of the reviewers have to a certain extent, but
yes.
The thing about the thing that I was trying to get at, and I didn't do a great job of it, is the way you seamlessly go from the beginning to this moment when a certain thing happens. Well, no, well they all say it. when the chest of drawers lifts, and there's mm-hmm. this person, and then there's this mask. But before that, and even during that, and after that, everything is so regular. It's so ordinary. It's like, okay, this is life with two kids while your husband, who I didn't think that much of, while your husband is, like, gone and not really responsible for everything for a week because he's doing whatever he thinks is important instead of the other thing. So while that's happening, it's like just regular stuff. But at the same time regular stuff is happening, the most amazing thing is happening. And the regular stuff keeps happening. And then I was thinking, okay, that's where I have to say, am I dealing with a reliable narrator or not?
Mm-hmm. And I see why you would question the level of reality in the book. And I'm open to that question. I understand and recognize that there is ambiguity in the book. But in my mind, what happens in the book, I, as I was writing it, thought of it in a very literal way, that the events described in the book take place in the book for real. But also, the entire book is a way of exploring a mental state that I would find it difficult to describe any other way except by pulling on some elements of thriller or some elements of science fiction. And as far as what you say, and I think you put it better than I could, about the mundane everyday reality running alongside these much more cosmic apocalyptic things, to me that is how life feels sometimes. I mean, even after you lose someone in your family, you still have to eat breakfast. And the book is dedicated to my sister Catherine, who died the same summer that my daughter was born. And so that summer I had the bounty of having a newborn baby and then the horrific loss of my sister, and to be having my first experience of motherhood just as my parents were losing their firstborn child just made me feel how much, alongside the diaper changing, alongside the nursing, there are also the biggest emotions of love and loss. So I really wanted to find a way that I could have those greater themes borne out in the daily act of caring for your children.
And that's one of the things I noticed about, not the interviews, but that one that was the 10 questions asked of you, and the other one too, is that you draw over this long period of time that this book took. You know, it's not like you have a scrapbook, but if you see something that you like, you cut it out, put it in the box. If mm-hmm. you hear something someone said, like James Joyce said, in the Nighttown part of Ulysses, you write it down, because sometimes those things are more interesting than things you could think up yourself. And so you gather all this stuff up, and then does it shape itself autonomously, or do you say, do you do like a little pin-up board like they do in crime scenes where, you know, you connect everything with a string, or how do you do that?
So it is, thank you for reading up so much on my process. I always love talking about process. I begin with sort of a 100-page list of just random tidbits, as you said, and images and overheard lines of dialogue and newspaper headlines and just anything that feels somehow in the enormous constellation of what I want the project or the book to be. And then I begin this sorting process, and I do it not on a pin-up board, although that's maybe not a bad idea, but usually just I print out the 100 pages and then kind of use a highlighter and start typing them in a more chronological order into a document. And I have some idea of the plot, and then I match up a certain image I have. Okay, this goes in this part of the plot, or this dialogue goes in this part of the plot. So I would not say it's a very, I have to shape the material a ton, and that is one of the most tiring parts of the process for me, is kind of figuring out how all of these random bits will fit together. But I love it. It's like doing this really intricate, complicated weaving. And I feel very when I'm doing it, I might have a headache by the time I'm done, but I've also been kind of in a flow for a matter of hours when I'm in that stage of the writing process.
There's nothing better than that flow. I remember
it's
one.
It's the best thing, yeah.
And there's that book called Flow by that author. I can't pronounce the title. I can't pronounce his name. But I practiced law for a long time. So when I was in trial, it was almost like, and I did medical negligence and stuff. And so it was like you. It was medical negligence, so I had to learn everything about the superior mesenteric artery and remember it for a few months. And and then when I was in the flow, cross-examining an expert witness usually, it was almost like I was on the ceiling looking down. And, you know, it just everything was just going to happen the way it happens, which kind of leads me off to my next totally off-the-wall question, which is, since you won the award, and if you read Barren in the Trees or if you read Cosmic Comics... You can't tell me that your book is meant to be read literally, because his books are meant to be read literally too. And, you know, when she says, "Oh, the pancakes I could make for you boys if only," you know, it's like, yeah, I mean, Cosmic Comics is a literal book, but that's what's so cool about what the two of you do, or what he did, is that you're reading it and you're thinking this guy just hung out up there for all of his life, and you're thinking, oh yeah, this, okay, that makes sense. And it's only when you're done that you go, no, that couldn't have happened.
Yeah, I mean, I love him. Like, speaking of his book Invisible Cities,
right,
which was one of my early favorites, those stories are about outrageous situations and outrageous scenarios, cities that are one city that is a bunch of ropes suspended above a chasm, and people are just living there above the chasm. But it's not, and so it's very fanciful, and they sleep on hammocks, and they hang their plants in the air and everything. But then it ends by saying something very important about our own life. It ends by saying the life of the people who live in the city Octavia hanging above the abyss, their life is less uncertain than our lives because they know their ropes will only hold out for so long. And so this idea that if you lived with that awareness of the abyss, maybe you'd live better than we do. And so he's painted this fanciful portrait of something, but he has this searing message that's deeply connected to real life. And that is something I absolutely aspire to in pretty much everything I write, that I'm often using, as I said, these conceits from science fiction or speculative fiction or thriller to say something that I don't think I could say with realism, but to say something about real life that I need to say, that I can't imagine any other way of saying it except by using some kind of outlandish scenario.
Well, that reminds me, because, well, first of all, I own a bookstore, so, you know, every single person says you can't judge a book by its cover, but there's not one person who walks into my bookstore that doesn't judge every book by its cover, unless they know what they're getting when they come in.
Yes, that's true.
And that's why publishers generally pick the covers. Well, actually, I should ask you, did you vet the cover? Did you pick it? Did you have anything to do with it?
I love the cover for The Need. In the original draft, rather than having the interwoven ferns on the cover, it had pink flowers. And a lot of the rest of the design was the same, and it had a strength to the size of the font and the black background. But I went back to my publisher and I said, you know, I really don't want pink flowers on this book. I don't think that's a good representation of the mood of the book. And so I was very pleased to come to a more neutral and, well, maybe not more neutral, just less female-looking, sort of overly feminized cover. I was very pleased. I am very pleased with the ferns. And if you look at them, too, they have a certain symmetry to them, but with variation, which obviously, without any spoilers, fits in very much with the themes of the book.
Oh, yeah. I thought not only that. I mean, I thought, given what was happening in the seam down there, that obviously I think it was pertinent. And then the concept which you touched on just now, the idea of fractalization of the ferns. And then also I'm fascinated by epigraphs, because, you know, the epigraphs in the cover aren't the book, but someone took a lot of time to think about them. And you have three epigraphs, and they're almost, in my opinion, kind of musical. And they again funnel down. You got something going on there with this funneling thing, at least in my opinion. So
And it reminds me of Nabokov's Transparent Things, that things can happen at the same time, they can happen at the same place, and then, you know, the idea of... And you end with Borges, which is kind of like ending with Calvino. So you must have spent a lot of time thinking, how am I going to drill this down so that people will understand, which I guess you're trying to do, what this book is going to be about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the three epigraphs. One is from the poet Mary Ruffel, and one is from the poet Jeffrey G. O'Brien, both of whom are published by Wave Books, and I just can't love Wave Books enough because they publish such interesting stuff. And then the third is from Borges. And all of them, they tie so directly to the book, not only thematically, but also in terms of images. And so I loved them for that, for having a real literal connection, because in the Mary Ruffel quote, she actually mentions a deer head. And that is a significant image in the book. And then in the Borges one, there's the concept of objects. If you could understand one small object, you could understand maybe entire universes. And that obviously ties into the strange discoveries that Molly is making in the pit. And then I'm not even going to speak about the O'Brien one, because I think it's a really direct connection to some of the spoilers in the book.
As you put it in the front of the book, though.
I know, I put it in the front of the book, but hopefully no one would notice it at that moment.
Well, that's what's so cool about it, is when you, if people remember, some people just skip them, but I mean, to me, it's like they're really, really important, because I know.
They're really important. Oh, yeah. I always read that first. I'm always so curious. And actually, I don't think any of my other books have ever had an epigraph. I've just never felt moved to have them before, or it didn't feel organic. And these three were just essential and organic and felt like such a natural fit with the book. And I don't know how they read as a trio, because I think they're kind of a weird trio. But once you read the book, I think they make perfect sense. But
I don't think they're weird at all. I think, I think they, I don't know why I keep saying funneling. I don't know why I think that. Something's funneling. But anyway.
Something's funneling. It's getting smaller. It's getting more pointed. Let's hope so.
Well, so when I graduated law school, my mother gave me this pocket watch, and the inscription inside was In omnibus partibus relucit totum, which means in each particle the whole repeats itself. And I've constantly, that's pretty much my motto, I guess. It's true. Mm-hmm. And that goes to the idea of you could just, and then you rely on the canon, you rely on Tennyson to say, if you could just figure this one little thing out. It goes back to quantum mechanics now, which is kind of where we are too. If you could just figure this one little thing out, then you pretty much have it. And it's the easiest thing to do, and it's the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
So we got to go back to selling the book. This is where I really screw up all the time, because, you know.
I really like that quote. Your mom is a wise person.
She died 1 month ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
No, it was a really good death. She was surrounded by her three sons. She never had one day of discomfort or pain. She sang until the day before she died. She laughed until the day before she died. We laughed together for 67 years. I knew the day she would stop laughing, and the day she stopped singing would be the day she said, okay, I'm going to check out now. And yes, things go. She was 96 and a half. Anyway, I'm still trying to sell your book, honestly.
This helps. I mean, it's the book, and I, you know, we don't need to touch on this too much, but as I said, the book is very much about loss, too, and I feel like that's a really core.
Yeah, it's about loss, and again, keeping away from spoilers and letting everybody know that these things are amazing in the book without telling you what they are. Like there's
we promise.
it's hard to do that. But there's this one moment towards the end where she have this moment of joinder, and it's almost, well, certainly sensual and slightly, if not more, sexual. And it's like, it's kind of like what we're talking about. It's like taking two things that are so far apart and yet creating this whole that's holistic. That's okay, this is the way things really are. And you're kind of saying, okay, guys, this is what I really mean. These things,
that seem like they're from completely, obviously, different worlds, different universes. Different universes really are tightly joined in a seamless way. That's not not a question, though.
I'm just going to say yes and nothing more. But thank you for saying that.
Okay. All right. So back to the book. So if we're going to talk about fear, which is, let's do it, inductively. If we're going to talk about fear, which the book concerns itself with in a great part of it. So in the smallest way, and then you can talk a little bit more about what they find. You can give as much information as you want what they find when the paleobotanists are looking for things. If we're going to talk about fear, what is it that causes fear in some of the people that come to visit the site next to the Phillips 66 station?
Well, there is something that they have found in their site where they are typically digging up plant fossils is they have discovered other artifacts that are similar to artifacts from our world, but slightly different, including a Coca-Cola can whose font tips the wrong direction or the different direction from the way our Coca-Cola insignia tilts. And one of those things is an alternate version of the Bible. I'm going to be very careful here. And so so some people are made very uncomfortable by that alternate version that they have discovered in the pit.
And again, towards the end, and I will not say anything other than the fact that it involves a baseball hat, that thing that she says to her when she says, you know, she looked a lot like, you know, that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that also really brought it together. That was very Calvino-ish, you know?
Yes. I my intention was that at the end of the book, you've been on uncertain ground in terms of what exactly to believe and what's happening. And at the end of the book, I really wanted that to explode outward and to not only have it be two lives that you were considering, but many other possible lives that were suddenly coming into relief in those final pages.
Yeah. And if you say it's literal, I mean, you didn't really say that, but I'm kind of making it up. But if you're saying it's meant to be literally read inside the pages, this is something I ask everyone. And I asked Emily and I ask everybody. And everyone has a different answer. It's like, okay, you're done. The book's done. Simon and Schuster have it. They release it, does great, gets optioned for a Netflix series. So when that happens, do you feel like, you know, okay, I'm done, it's out there. Is it my firstborn child? I don't know. It's out there in the real world. Am I allowed to do whatever I want with it? Me, the reader?
You mean you as the reader?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that that's a hard thing to accept as a writer, that you put something out there. It's both the hardest thing about it and the most wonderful thing about it. It's really hard. You cede control. You know, the book is published and I was so tightly controlled in everything. I mean, every single word choice, every single comma, I thought about it. I read every sentence in that book aloud several times to make sure that it had just the right valence. So I was a control freak in that part of the process. But when it goes out into the world, I cede control. I can't really be a control freak anymore. I could control that step of what the thing is, what the piece is. But then, as I said, it starts to bounce off of other brains. And then there's a collaboration between the work and the reader. And so different readers will find different things in it. One reader recently said to me she read it as a ghost story, which I found fascinating, hadn't occurred to me. But fine, if for her it's a ghost story and that's one way that she approaches it, I embrace that. So you have to accept, I think, that any act of reading is a collaboration with the reader.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think you can control the valence. I mean, if you got a proton and a neutron, you have electrons orbiting in the shells, and one hops from one place to another, I don't think you, as the author, unfortunately, do have control of that. You may think you do.
Probably not. I mean, I try to control as much as I can. Like, I'll make sure that certain adjectives, I'll really think about where does that adjective appear and do I want it to appear at that other place as well. And, you know, I feel like a control freak, but we never have control. And that's actually really mainly the theme of the book at the end of the day, is how little control we have and kind of how you live your best life without having true control over your, over what will happen to you.
And that's why I think, well, there's two ways of looking at a book, and this is something I always say in an interview as well. I mean, some people, you know, and if this is a book club book, there'll be a fight over, I call my book clubs fight clubs.
That's nice.
So, you know, some people like their books wrapped up, you know, they like them put in a box, and I've said this many times, and put in wrapping paper and tied with a ribbon and a little card, and then you hand it to the reader, and that's it. And other people, me, want the book to say, okay, it ends, and who is in control? And, like, okay, what's going to happen now? What could possibly happen now? And I'm allowed to extrapolate that and, you know, wonder about that and spend a lot of time, which I have, thinking about how this could have possibly play out beyond the end. And I think, and that's true of the other authors we've been talking about, is, you know, I think they leave it in a situation where the reader has to ponder. So you're not taking that pondering away by, I don't think you're taking
no.
it at all.
No, that's critical to me. And I'm glad you spent some time on the end, because I rewrote it uncountable times and really tried to get the level both of ambiguity and suggestiveness right with the ending. And I guess one way I would describe the ending is to say that I intend for it to be a mirror held up to the reader, and whatever you sort of your pick your own adventure understanding of what happens at the end perhaps reveals more about you than about the book.
I think so. I think especially for intelligent people who have spent a lot of their time thinking about what you thought when you were 11 years old. It does.
What if?
Yeah.
What if?
Yeah, and it resonates. And I just had this talk over the coffee counter at my bookshop with this guy who constantly comes in talking about quantum physics until I say, I have my employees like call me and pretend like it's an important call. And I say, I got to take this call so I don't have to talk to him anymore. I hope he's not listening. But anyway, he's always talking about, like, every single moment, splits off, splits off, splits off, splits off. And like I said at the beginning, I think that's, you know, if you look at this, if you look at this froth of a universe, of a multiverse that's infinite in time and space, much like your epigraph suggests, and again, without spoiling, if God is whatever face is presented by that God, how does that, why'd you slide that in there so prominently if theoretically God had to have an infinite number of manifestations? Because you're positing this infinite number of manifestations, but you're also positing that the deity is present in another one. You know what I mean? I mean, is he there, he, she, there, everywhere?
You mean because the Bible is so central in the book?
Yeah. I mean, the Bible is central in a book that's not about an ordinary world or universe.
Mm-hmm. That is a deep question. Do I really have to answer this question right now?
No, you can answer it next week if you want.
I don't know. I mean, what could be more sacred than contemplating all the possible ways that a universe could unfold? That seems very sacred and miraculous to me.
Yeah, but it's beyond our comprehension. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I'm sure we believe things now that are as outrageous as people believing that the Earth was flat. I think about that often, that who knows what we will come to know that we don't know now. It gives me a sense of awe and a sense of wonder, and I'm not a scientist, but I kind of wish I were. I mean, I made my protagonist a scientist who contemplated geologic time.
Yeah. Hey, why are the keys so important in this book? The keys are really important to the car.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to tell me, but...
Yeah. I mean, I'll just say that I'm interested in objects and the way that they... we invest a lot of meaning in objects.
I had this dream once, and my father had already died, and he came to me, and he was on this horse, and he was dressed like this king, and he handed me these keys, and I knew that they were the keys to the most important thing in the world, and unfortunately, there was a flood, and I had to get to this box, like this treasure box, but the treasure box was being flooded, so it was underwater, and I had to swim and try to get to it. And the dream was about me swimming to the box with the key that I knew would open the box, but I never actually got to the box. Mm-hmm. I just kept swimming.
Yeah.
Which kind of reminded me of that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's not unlike the keys in the book serving as this kind of hint that unfolds everything.
Yeah. It's interesting how you did that with the pocketbook and the keys. And, you know, it's like, it was kind of a sleight of hand on your part, but it definitely, I mean, it wasn't like it was pivotal, but it definitely meant something, and you could tell right away that it meant something. So,
well, again, I like to think of I like to infuse mundane objects with sacred power, and you see that happening a lot in the book.
Oh, yeah, the penny.
The penny.
The penny,
I've never looked so closely at a penny as I did when I was writing those scenes. I had to just stare at that penny and do a lot of penny research, and it was fascinating.
I did the same thing. In the same year, and I'm looking and seeing. Yeah.
Yeah. My dream is that people will pull pennies out of their wallet when they read that scene and be like, oh, yeah, I've never noticed that there's, you know, this or that on the penny. So.
It's the only reason, actually, that I can think of the pennies should exist in the first place is that you brought them up in your book.
Otherwise, thank you. It's a humble little coin indeed.
Yeah, at the bookstore, I just round everything down. I'm sick of pennies, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which they do at a lot of stores.
Well, I think they're more valuable now. Like, the metal used to make them is more valuable than 1 cent.
Yeah, true. It costs more than...
So that's sort of a weird... That feels like an existential question of some kind. But anyway, they still make them.
Yeah, I remember I read, and I think it was Cannery Row or something like that, and John Steinbeck was, you know, being the socialist he was, communist he was talking about the valuelessness of money, and the only time he ever saw any money that was worth anything at all was when he put a nickel in the jukebox, and the nickel actually connected the two electrodes that allowed the song to play.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. What else do you want to talk about? I can't think of anything else. Is that it?
This was great. This was definitely unique among my interviews in terms of the territory covered and the sorts of questions asked. So I thank you for that.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure talking to you about it. And like I said at the beginning, it's just a remarkable book. And, you know, it's... And I must confess, I hadn't read your previous four, and I will now immediately. And I've already stocked them in the bookstore, too. So, and hopefully that's what's going to happen with all of them, I would hope. And maybe you will. Who knows? Maybe this is a perfect book to option for a series, right?
It seems that is in the realm of possibility.
Oh, cool.
But based on your questions, I really want you to read The Beautiful Bureaucrat, because that is, yeah, I just, if you have a moment or many moments, I would love to hear your take on that someday.
Okay, I will. And I would love to hear your take on other things. So if we ever do get, which we will, in the book club, maybe you can Skype in. And if you're ever around town and you want to come by and read or sign or just have a drink or something like that, that would be great.
You're in Massachusetts? Wait, no Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania, okay. Chester. Just outside of Philadelphia.
Okay. I will keep that in mind. I'd like to be Skyped into the Fight Club.
Okay, that'd be great. All right, thanks, Helen. It was a pleasure.
Okay, my pleasure. All take right. care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So we were talking with Helen Phillips. As usual, I kind of like, I'm glad she said she liked it because I really was going all around. So anyway, you know, I never say, Ron McNeil was telling me, you know, I never say what my bookstore is. And I'm thinking, well, you know,
it's not really fair to bother the reader with why I'm here. But, yeah, Wellington Square Bookshop. It's just past the intersection of the Downingtown Turnpike, Pennsylvania Turnpike, Downingtown intersection. So you get off, you go into this community called Eagle View, that my father started back in the early 80s, and my brothers and I have been working on ever since. And in Eagle View, there's a town center that has restaurants, it has hair salons, it has dog grooming places, it has insurance companies, it has, like 5 or 6 restaurants, actually. And it has all kinds of things that, you know, health and fitness places, ACAC is there. It's just that it's hard to find. You know, you go in to Eagle View where there's this giant eagle. The only other one is owned by Ross Perot. And you go in there and follow the signs to the town center, and my bookstore is upstairs next to Gemini and Rita's. And it's across from ACAC. And we have a full selection of all kinds of new books, collectible books, rare books, used books from my old library. We have a coffee shop that has pastries. We have children's story hour on Tuesdays at 10 o'clock. We have lots and lots of book clubs. We have lots of author events. We have a great website, wellingtonsquarebooks.com. We have a newsletter you can subscribe to. We have a frequent buyer club that gives you $5 off when you spend $100. See, what else can I tell that I've never told before? The coolest thing is, if you're in Westchester, you know, everyone goes, oh, it's so far away. It's 15 minutes away from where I'm talking now on Gay Street. So you can just go up 100 North and make a left by the Hilton Garden Inn and the Spring Hill Suites, and there you are. Okay, so enough of that. I finally plugged myself after, 7 years. Okay, so in any event, we have a bunch of good stuff coming up, which I have listed here somewhere. Oh, yeah. Edwidge Danticat, who's going to discuss her latest collection of short stories, Everything Inside, and Orson Scott Card, which I can't believe I got. His new novel is Lost and Found, but you guys know him from Ender's Game. And Speaker for the Dead and Xenocide and all these other great books he's written. And Ender's Game has been, like, I think, a movie twice. And one of the best hard sci-fi novels ever. And it predicted presciently, much like William Gibson's Neuromancer, pretty much what's going on in the world right now. I mean, Ender's Game, it's like, heck, there's kids in Miami that are remotely controlling drones that are flying above Afghanistan, and they have the ability to either imaginarily or in real life destroy or not villages and people without having any necessarily emotional attachment to what they're doing. So anyway, I really look forward to that, and maybe I'll ask a question just like that. So in any event, thanks as always for joining us, and I look forward to having you here with us hopefully next week on The Avid Reader. Okay, so I just realized I have a PS, which is kind of like an apology to you guys, because I know every week I say the same thing about some people like their books put in a box, wrapped up, tied with a ribbon, and then I always ask, okay, now your book is out in the world, your firstborn is gone, blah, 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 blah. So I just want to apologize. There's these questions I ask that I, you know, is your book magical realism or not? Those kinds of things. But the reason I ask them is because every author has a different answer. So I figure, why not keep asking them? You know, eventually, maybe we'll drill down to our own answer. Or maybe we'll figure out, hey, you know what? That's my answer. That's what I think, too. So even though it might sound pedantic as I do it, or repetitive as I do it, which it certainly is, there is a kind of method to my madness, if there ever is any method to my madness. So thanks for indulging me on that. And okay, I'll leave you there.